All right, we'll get started with the Q&A time now. If you have never been to a Cafe Sci before, the way our Q&A will work is we have two wireless microphones that will circulate the audience. I will have one. Sarah will have the second. So if you have a question, flag one of us down. We'll come to you, hand you the microphone so you can ask your question so everybody can hear it and so it can be on the recording. We're recording, the lecture was recorded. We'll record the cafe or the Q&A for our podcast. So if you enjoyed what you heard tonight, want to listen to some previous lectures, or have a friend who missed tonight and you really want them to hear it, you can find the lecture on our podcast website at carnegiesciencecenter.podomatic.com. And you can find that up there within the next couple of days. I'll have it online. So make sure you speak into the microphone so everybody can hear. Remember, you're flagging down Sarah or myself. We usually try to alternate between upper and lower sections. So if you're waving us down and we don't come right away, we're not ignoring you on purpose. We're just trying to make our rounds, all right? So if we have our first question, we'll bring Ela back on to start our Q&A.
Could you please explain the other four books up there, or three in your...
Absolutely. I'll explain the other books. They told me I have to talk here now because you guys have the wireless mics, so I'm stuck. The third book from the left on the top row is by Thomas Guerin on the sociology of science. It's a really fascinating book because it talks about how poor scientists and technologists are at understanding the downstream impact that their statements and their technology decisions have. In other words, they invent things, they get funding from agencies, and they don't understand the degree to which they change the world. They change the future, and they change people's perceptions by speaking about their technologies or even by deciding what technologies to work on. So this is a sociology book that is absolutely excellent. It has a whole section on cold fusion, and it reminds us of cold fusion, reminds us of why that whole debacle happened, and how the PR machine of the University of Utah really caused it to happen, together with Congress. And it's an excellent lesson that we shouldn't forget. The rightmost book on the top row, Raw Data is an Oxymoron, is really interesting because it reminds us that there is no data collection that is unbiased. Everything that we collect, all the statistics, all of the survey forms, everything has massive bias inbuilt. And the challenge is understanding the bias and trying to use the data in an informed way in spite of the bias. The second from the right on the bottom row, Super Crunchers, is really interesting because it's about data collection on the internet and the degree to which your activities are now predicted based on your trail on the internet. So how companies can figure out what you've done in the past on the internet by using your computer and how they can predict what you're going to do next, what you'll buy, what movies you'll watch, which websites you'll go to. So it's an amazing book that talks about the degree to which predicting our behavior as humans has become a science. And you can imagine, for me, the scary part is going from predicting our behavior to the next step, which is manipulating our behavior, is a next natural progression. And that's the part that really scares me. And the rightmost book is my book. And I did bring a number of copies of that in case people want to get it. So I have it, and I'm happy to sell it at cost.
I was wondering if you could talk about the ways that the developing world is sort of going off on their own tangents in terms of using technology and hacking technology and wonderful things like that.
The developing world is a really fantastic test case, because in some cases the developing world has managed to leapfrog some problems that the developed world had. If you look at internet technologies and cellular technologies, for instance, vast parts of Central Africa went straight from no telephone to cellular. They never went through copper wire. They never went through the standard telephony systems that we have. At the same time, the developing world is where a lot of our resource extraction happens. You know, America is a little bit unusual in that we have massive resource extraction and we have a developed economy. Europe doesn't do that nearly as much as we do. Instead, you turn to the developing world, especially places like Africa and China, where you have extreme levels of agricultural production and resource extraction. When I say resource extraction, I mean everything from fracking to mining to many other activities, but various kinds of mining. So in the developing world, there's a lot of watershed issues today and a lot of pollution issues. It's interesting because air pollution is one of the major results of resource extraction because of the degree to which you use things like diesel systems to compress and treat whatever you're doing in the middle of the desert, say, in Namibia. So air pollution or water pollution are, in a way, much more fervently sought-after problems in the developing world than they are here. And as a result, I found we get a lot more traction for technologies that help communities understand the degree to which they have pollution in the developing world. Here, you have a bit of a fiction where people believe my city's okay, right? People look around and say, I don't see pollution. Things are fine here. Yeah, it was city. If I go to my attic, I can see black soot on the walls, but it's fine now. And what they don't get is that a third of the children in Pittsburgh have asthma, and there's a reason for that. That's not normal. It's highly irregular. And so they don't understand the severity of the problem. So data understanding is interesting because if we understood data, if we were fluent in data, I think we would start to understand the risks that we face much more directly.
I have a two-part question.
Where are you?
Up here.
Ah, okay.
I have a two-part question. The first one is, everyone's read the book or seen the movie I, Robot. And the primary directive is not to ever hurt a human being. And I hear very little discussion about this. And within 40 years, I would think it would be very, very important. I'd like to get your thinking on that and why it's not being discussed at a worldwide level, that there is not a primary directive being incorporated in these machines that will be very complex and very intelligent. The second part is, since we will all probably see within the next 10 years autonomous cars on the road, how are these autonomous cars being programmed? In other words, going back to the prime directive, if a car is going to hit a wall or run over two pedestrians, it has a choice whether to go into the wall or kill the two pedestrians. Is the car going to be programmed to save the passenger's life and kill the two people by not running into the wall? Or is the car going to be programmed to save the two people on the sidewalk by hitting the wall and killing the passenger? Now, that will be determined by the company that makes the car, or is it going to be programmed by the individual that's in the car? He's going to make that decision.
The repercussions of those questions. Let me start with the car, with just an observation about cars and complexity. One of the things that we don't have good fluency around in our society and what we don't teach our children is about systems and how, as systems get more complex, our ability to predict how they behave falls off dramatically. And I'll give you an example, which is the Toyota braking system. So the Toyota Prius has a hybrid braking system where it uses the electric power. It charges the battery to slow down, and it uses the brake pads to slow down. And, you know, they test these cars relatively well. You know, they pass the U.S. Department of Transportation guidelines, right? And what's interesting is, in spite of all that testing, you're putting millions of cars on the road. And so every once in a while, one of the cars will be in a truly unusual situation, where by unusual I mean only 10 other cars have ever been in that situation ever. And so in their case, it was just the right vibration of the wheel, such that the accelerometers in the wheel that measure vibration were confused. And that just right vibration, coupled with just braking at the right time, causes the brakes not to engage for a little while. Now, Toyota couldn't have tested for that, because by the time you've built a car as complex as the Prius, you can't test for every possible environmental situation thoroughly, exhaustively. So the result was a small handful of people, 5, 6, 7 people, had very, very scary encounters with near accidents and I think a couple of accidents where they pushed on the brakes and nothing happened. You can imagine that's sort of the scariest thing that could happen to you, right? You push on the brakes and nothing happens. And it's a lesson in the idea that as systems become more complex, on the fringes of the statistics, things will happen that are very unsavory indeed because we can't possibly test for all of them. Now, let's go back to your question about cars, and they're autonomous. Autonomous cars will be more complex than today's cars, by a fair margin. And we will never be able to comprehensively test them. So one oddity of the entire autonomous car debate is going to be that we are going to be trading a certain kind of error for a new kind of error. Today, 60,000 people run off the road and die because they're drunk or they're sleepy and they fall asleep, single car, and they go off the road and they die. And you can blame them. You have somebody to blame. You can say that he fell asleep, or you can say he was drinking, or he made a mistake. We live in a different world when you have autonomous cars that stop you from doing that. And instead of 60,000 people dying every year, 2,000 people die every year because of random, complex system bugs that will happen. And those 2,000 errors and deaths aren't resulting from some blamable incident where you can point to somebody and say, well, he wasn't paying attention. It's a lottery. We'll all play a small lottery. Many fewer people will die. It's got a certain prime directive feel to it. But the people who die are going to be randomly selected from amongst all people rather than from sleepy people or drinking people. So it's a complex world that you enter when you do that. Now, going back to your questions, one interesting issue is Asimov and his laws. And it's been fantastic to watch the debate here about Asimov and the laws in my community, because a number of roboticists talk about Asimov's three laws and the incorporation of those laws into robots. And I think these are all the computer scientists who never read iRobot or his other books, because what they failed to comprehend is that he was writing these laws to demonstrate how you can't write laws. Because as soon as you write those laws, you find exceptions and weird situations where you have to do the opposite of the law, otherwise it's much worse. And so indeed, Asimov was prescient in understanding that you can't necessarily codify ethical behavior. And as soon as we have machines that act in society, we have to make decisions about how they will behave ethically. And when we write rules for that, there will be loopholes. There will be times when the rule we wrote as written isn't quite right. After all, there's no cookbook for all of us to act ethically. It's our experience as a human over time that makes us able to do that. So going to your example of the sidewalk and the wall is really interesting. Today, if you're in Denver, Colorado, and you're a bus driver, you are taught certain things. If a bicyclist swerves in front of you and you're driving your bus and you have a load of passengers on the bus, what do? You keep driving straight and you kill the bicyclist. That's the rule for the bus company of Denver, Colorado, and I know this firsthand. Why is that the rule? That's the rule because of two things. One, if there was any other rule, if you were allowed to swerve, you could kill your passengers, a lot of them, rather than that one bicyclist. And second, if you swerve and somebody gets a broken arm on the bus and you avoid the bicyclist, they can sue you. So we actually have not just ethical ramifications that will govern what that car does, we have the world of liability that will also govern that car's behavior. And that's going to be quite a thick pudding to get through, because the lawyers will be saying, here's how the cars have to behave to minimize risk to the car companies who are supplying you with that autonomous car. And that, in the end of the day, will be one of the main drivers of how they behave. So indeed, that imagining that world in which we have autonomous cars has all these weird repercussions that we don't think of today, from the world of lottery to the world of, you know, liability minimization for companies. And minimizing liability for companies does not necessarily ever align particularly well to your well-being as a passenger. So your questions are excellent. I have no good answers to them, but they're very good questions to consider.
You were talking about something like, I think maybe digital labor, or maybe how predicting behavior, and you just said as an aside, as with the Huffington Post. What can you tell us about the Huffington Post?
Well, the Huffington Post is an interesting example because of the major debate that was launched when the Huffington Post was sold by Arianna Huffington to Bloomberg? To one of the major news corporations. Maybe to News Corp. I think News Corp bought it. What was interesting about that is the Huffington Post is an all-volunteer blog system. So everybody who writes on the Huffington Post, and I'm one of the writers on the Huffington Post, so I do it. We write, and we don't get any money, but we bring a lot of traffic to the Huffington Post. And yet we do it because people read the articles, right? You want the attention. What's interesting is Arianna Huffington managed to sell it for a whole lot of money. to News Corporation. And a lot of the bloggers said, wait a minute. You're selling something that has content. All the content on your site was written by us. Are you planning to distribute some of the funding to us? And the answer was, oh no, of course not. That would be like Facebook selling itself to Microsoft or something. I know that's impossible, I know. And then distributing money to everybody who has a Facebook account because they're the people who've created content that causes people to go to Facebook. And that doesn't happen. So the Huffington Post is an interesting example of the new economy in which people who aren't paid do work that creates content online. And then they don't get paid for it, but somebody else makes the money. Your behavior online is the very same thing. When the Advantage Card is something that you use, the folks who have a database at the Advantage Card side can track your behavior. They can learn what things you buy with what other things. Now, they erase your name. They don't associate your name with that. But they don't just use that to make Giant Eagle a more profitable place. They sell that to other supermarkets. So your shopping creates data that they sell. That's digital labor, so to speak. You're doing labor resulting in digital stuff, digital goods, that people can then buy and sell multiple times on the internet to make money. And the only person who doesn't make money in that entire system is the original producer, you.
Justin? Yeah. We touched a little privately there. I do want to say that I'm sure we all found your lecture extremely interesting and very well presented, so we want to thank you for that. My question really relates to what I brought up. What are the solutions in terms of political control, population growth, and jobs? I mean, prior to we becoming robots.
How do we solve, political disaster, population growth, and jobs? Yes, good question. You should get in the same room sometime. The two of you you're asking good questions. We need 24 hours until self-destruction here. So the reason I wrote the book is because I don't think we have discourse about this. I don't think we talk about this as a society enough. We don't talk about chronic underemployment. We don't talk about what automation is doing to society, to middle-income society. So I believe the first step has to be that we talk to one another. I believe a second step is to create a technologically fluent society, which means starting at the early childhood level and changing the way we think about educating children. But neither of those solves the problem when the super powerful control innovation and they control essentially the entire political economic system. So I can't solve the problem. All I know is that there has to be a first step involving discussion, and there has to be a second step involving core education. But that doesn't solve the problem. It's necessary but not sufficient, let's say. If anybody else knows the answer, please come up here and tell us the answer. Go ahead.
Good evening. I'm wondering about the singularity and when you think that might occur if you had to guess a date range, and how you feel about how you describe it.
So the question is, when do I think the singularity will occur? So let me explain what the singularity is a little bit and then explain my feelings about it. So the singularity idea is that we essentially, the basic idea is that we get to the point where robots and computers are smart enough that they design the next generation of robots and computers that are even smarter than they are. And then they do it again and again, and you can follow this logic. Suddenly you have the rapid evolution of machines by machines, and we're kind of left out in the dust going, wow, look at that cool machine. That's the idea. And the corollary to that that often is stated is that the singularity means that robots and machines become our evolutionary progeny. They become the next version of humanity. And the third idea is immortality, that once this happens, the machines can figure out how to download our consciousness so we all become immortal. So that's the general concept of singularity in a very, very small nutshell. When it can happen is a question that I disagree with, because I believe the bar keeps changing. And I believe the fundamental problem is, if you look at the way technology has progressed, right now we have communication devices that are far more effective than what we had 20 years ago. the cell phone got much better. You know, the phone got much better. We don't have walking, talking androids that do our dishes. We have really good phones. Typically, the things that have improved in terms of technology are things that cause communication between people or entertainment for people. Those are the two places where we have major revolutions in technology, technological changes, entertainment and communication. I don't think that's going to change so much in the near future. So I'm not sure we're going to make computers that improve computers that improve computers. I think we're going to make even more entertainment, even more three-dimensional, amazing virtual world entertainment, pick your own story adventures, and communication, right? You'll be able to talk to more people, have meetings with more people, and as I said, have personal digital assistants that help you be almost like five people in one whenever you choose. The idea of singularity by 2050 or 2040, I believe this idea that we're exponential based on the number of neurons in our eye and our brain, which is usually what's used as a measure, I think that's off, because I think the question is what it takes to make something truly creative. And we haven't really figured out creativity and learning, kind of deep learning, the way humans do it. Sorry, I'm hedging on your question because I don't have a good answer. When I look at this in terms of what the debate about singularity has done, that's where I get upset, because talking about the singularity so much has caused our society to stop paying attention to the fact that pre-singularity, we can have many, many advances in robotics and computers that make society a much less pleasant place to be. In other words, we can be talking about mediocre machinery that takes our jobs. We don't need singularity. We don't need humanoids to take our jobs. We can have half-hearted machines that will take our jobs. They don't have to talk like us and look like us and be indistinguishable from us, but they'll still take our jobs. They'll still mean we have chronic underemployment. And they'll still mean that marketers will be able to do much more powerfully than they can now in terms of controlling our choices, our purchasing choices. So part of the problem is, I think, the singularity will get redefined. Maybe the singularity is going to be when we are basically less strong than our machines. Not because they're as smart as a human, but because they're being used by other humans in such intricate, sophisticated ways that we're basically becoming powerless. That's a problem. In the book, I actually go forward to 2045, 2075, 2150, and I imagine the future that I believe will occur at those ages. Luckily, I won't be alive for most of them, so can't be proven wrong. But I never get to singularity, even when I go out to 2150. So my personal opinion is no singularity even by 2150, I guess.
Hello?
Hi, I was just wondering with respect to the Huffington Post, It seems like, and that kind of content creation, it seems like it's not such a new thing. I mean, if you were an aspiring performer, you might perform for free because you get exposure, and you know, bands, comedians, they're used to having to do this, and people who use Facebook are freely doing it because they get the value that they want from Facebook. So I don't see what's sinister about it. Or what's new, really. It's just a larger scale.
I'll repeat the question. So the question is, you know, is there really anything sinister or new about the idea of people doing kind of volunteer work? You're a new comedian, you're going to perform so that you get known. And if you're using Facebook, you're deriving value from the very fact that you're using Facebook, so that's the value you're getting. You don't need to get paid. And that's completely true. You're right. There's nothing sinister about it. What's interesting, though, about it is that you see a sea change in entire fields like journalism. So, for instance, it used to be that the journalistic profession was a profession of master tradesmen. These were people who've gone to school, learned how to do research, learned how to do investigative journalism, and can spend, and sometimes weeks, on an article, interviewing, questioning, writing, and then publishing. So, and they got paid well to do it. So you had a professional core of journalists who did that. The same thing was true in documentary production. You had Nova at WGBH. They would spend literally 6 months researching and producing a single science documentary after extreme amounts of work setting up just the right content. And the trend that I see that things like Huffington Post represent are interesting because by massively broadening the number of people who are so-called journalists, you undermine the master tradesmen of journalism. You undermine the amount of money they can make, and the number of people who can be journalists as a career with a livelihood. And by the same token, WGBH has now laid off, as of last year, every producer they had on staff. They simply contract out two-week short throw operations, just like the Discovery Channel. So the interesting bit is, you're absolutely right, there's nothing nefarious about it. But this is all steps in a system that makes the press vehicle, like Huffington Post, much cheaper to operate, which is important because newspapers can't sell as much, so you know they want to get cheaper to operate to stay in business. But they make themselves cheaper to operate in a way that has a sea change effect on an entire profession. And unfortunately, this is profession by profession true. This is true of master craftsmen in the world of machining and milling and lathing as well. This is true of draftsmen in the world of electronic board layout. You can name multiple professions against which levels of crowdsourcing or automation are redefining the number of people that can be there and how much they can get paid in fairly dramatic ways. Another nice example is the robot arm. Baxter is a new robot arm made by a company in Boston, Massachusetts. Instead of $200,000, it's $20,000. Now, there's a set of companies that the Atlantic Monthly did an in-depth article on. This is an in-depth journalistic article, right? So they flew out to these companies and interviewed them about when they replace a person in the machine room with a robot arm. And they said, it's easy. We look at 2 years ROI. Can the robot arm pay for itself in 2 years? So a $200,000 robot is kind of hard to pay for itself in 2 years. The new Baxter arm, $20,000, they were interviewing the managers who said, yep, we're going to lay off three people here. Because at $20,000, this thing pays for itself in 6 months. And then they were interviewing the machinist. In this one case, it was a single mother who had two kids saying, so you're going to lose your job now. And she said, yeah, if I had one higher certification, I could work on the CNC mill and I'd be okay for now. But I can't get that because I'm bouncing between this daycare, that school, I'm coming here to work, I just don't have time to get the certification. You know, it's just a simple, single human story. But the problem is when you have that $20,000 robot, it changes the calculus of how employment and underemployment can happen. It changes what it takes to have value in society. And it changes the degree to which people have to invest in an education to be able to outrun the leading edge of automation faster than it can catch up with them, which is a real problem. But every incremental step is not nefarious. It's not ill will. It just adds up to a whole that leads to a trend that I find scary.
Well, from the beginning, it felt like you were talking about Big Brother. And I want to know, who is Big Brother?
That's a good question. My Big Brother is Alex, but that's not what you want to know. And he's a nice Big Brother. So it's interesting. In this case, Big Brother becomes the owners of data. It's the purveyors of data, the people who own it, who can interpret it, and who can make decisions from it. And that can be governmental, and that can also be private. But you know the companies that have lots of data. In the end of the day, they're the ones who have value. And as we are under greater amounts of surveillance, we've heard about that from the NSA leaks every week now, right? Somebody has that data. And I'll give you an interesting knock-on example from Snowden. So they're getting massive amounts of data, and then they have to sift through it. The NSA isn't doing this by hiring all the people directly to sift through the data. They're contracting companies. What's interesting about this is there's new companies that are being born now to contract massive amounts of behavioral big data. They're getting basically startup funds from the NSA to learn how to do massive data understanding on behavioral surveillance. And these some companies are saying outright already now, this is awesome. We're being basically funded by the NSA, funded by the government to exist. And after we hone our tools and figure out how to do this right, we can sell massive data surveillance mining to every other company on Earth. So there's a knock-on consequence, right? Big Brother is the company that owns the data that funds new companies to learn how to create whole new tools to make even more leverage out of that data, and then you, in turn, can sell that to more companies. So everybody's data becomes more valuable because now you can mine it better. I guess big data is everybody except the individual.
What are the military implications of this? Can you speak about that? The military implications?
The military implications are tricky and complicated. One side of it has to do with this question of robot war. And we're certainly headed in a direction right now where we control warfare, or at least limited warfare, in as remote a way as possible. And there's a major political reason for that, which is to not risk our own lives in doing so. But one of the funny side effects that Wired for War talks about is that the people who do the control, the people who are teleoperating these machines, are coming away with significantly disproportionate amounts of post-traumatic stress disorder, because they're being teletransported from a cubicle where they're in a war theater to a car ride where they're going home trying to buy a present for their daughter whose 8th birthday is tonight. And apparently going between these two worlds every day, morning and night, sleeping in bed with your wife and then bombing people in the day, is being highly stressful and anxiety-provoking on people. So one side of this is we don't actually understand exactly the repercussions this will have, even on the individual soldier's well-being. On the other side, we have the question of the calculus of war. Does it become easier or harder to engage in war and not spend as laborious a process on trying to make peace when the cost of war decreases over time, or the negative ramifications of war in terms of deaths of your own soldiers, you know, coffins with flags draped on them coming out of the C-130? So that's a whole other side to it. There's actually a movement called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. It's being run by Human Rights Watch, and out of England. It's also being run out of England. And what they're saying is there's a series of war-fighting drones now that make decisions about when to kill and when not to kill. And they're saying that's an interesting line in the sand we should draw and not go beyond. So I'll give you an example. There's something called lurking munitions that are now being developed. Actually, they've been developed. They're being put out into the field by England, by the UK. They work like regular munitions, except you give them an infrared shape that you care about. You launch them like regular munitions, and then instead of going up and coming back down and landing, they go up and then they hover above the target city for up to 6 hours. And they have cameras looking down, infrared cameras, and they look for the infrared shape you gave them. And when something matches them to a certain percentage, then they go there and drop and explode. It's making a decision using a sensor. Just like an autonomous car making a decision using a sensor. And it changes the psychology of war. Because when you're in London and the alarms go off and it's World War II and you run to the shelter, bombs drop, they hit, the lottery has happened, the die has been cast, then you come back up. But when you have a lurking munition, they fire the munition, it's hovering. Now you have 6 hours of utter existential anxiety when you don't know what's going to happen, when you don't know if the shape of your ice cream truck happens to be too similar to the shape of a tank. So that changes the psychology of warfare as well as the way that we fight wars. And so this one group is trying to say, perhaps we should at least specify that robots shouldn't make decisions about when to kill, so that you always have direct human control over killing. The philosophical side of that is this idea that killing is such a deep concept, the idea of killing, that humans should always be in the line of responsibility of killing, having it go from the robot to the programmer, to the conditions that was programmed, to the statistics, to the sensor, seems like it's too far away from humans for something so inhumane as killing. But certainly war will change dramatically because of robotic systems and drones. Georgia Tech, by the way, already has demonstrated quad rotors that have face recognition algorithms on board and paint guns. So they can look at your face, determine that your face matches a face in a database, and then shoot you with paint guns. And they're doing this. This is not simulated. This is actually being done with real quad rotors today. And obviously weaponizing a quad rotor that has that paint gun on it is almost completely trivial. Yes?
So what can we do at a social responsibility level to do something about all this extensive privacy invasion, basically? I mean, I've thought about this often. Whenever someone asks for my email, I think that every time I have to check off a box so that I can use the Yahoo Mail, which allows them to know my location, or I download an app and it lists all these things that it can now control on my phone. When I park in a meter and I have to put in my license plate, so now there's a permanent record of everywhere I've been forever. You know, I mean, we're following all this stuff around like sheep, and so a few of us in this room are now aware of this that weren't before, but what do we do about it? Like, it started with the Patriot Act. What do we do to, like, prevent, what can we do to make a change? And to what extent should we?
There's little things we do that are almost useless. I don't use an Advantage card. What good did that do, right? I mean, it's a drop in the pan or bucket, sea. I don't have a good answer for you. You know, I used to think, okay, I'm not going to have the go-fast pass in my car. I'm going to pay cash when I go through the meter. And I still do pay cash, but guess what? They're actually tracking all license plates anyway now. They have a database of every license plate, even if you pay with your quarters when you pay the toll on the turnpike. So it's gone. You know, for the sake of security, the United Kingdom has massive numbers of cameras, some 20,000 cameras in London. We're going to eventually do that in all our cities here for security. But it means there will be databases that subpoenas can access with all this data. If you look at Europe, they have taken a different stance on many of these directions, mainland Europe. For instance, any car that's being driven in Germany can't record any of the GPS readings. So it can show you where you are on the map and show you your path, but it can't record the readings. And I know this because I've worked with Bosch on an electric car project. And the reason they can't do that is because of privacy. Because if we record the readings, then eventually it could be pulled out in a court of law. Or somebody could hack it and know exactly where you've been. So looking at European privacy regulations might be educational. But the only way I know to stem this is to make the new generation as aware of it as possible in a very broad way. That's right. They have no interest in privacy. So that's exactly the problem. The new generation has been fed applications, and they've been fed value that comes from a complete lack of privacy. It comes from utter transparency, right? I mean, you can put, you know, pictures that are very bad, right? You can share the pictures that are ugly. You can be drunk and look terrible, and you share it, and that's good. You get points for doing that. Nothing is private. Nothing is unobscene. Inappropriate was the word I was looking for. So the idea of inappropriateness is sort of disappearing because of the way applications have developed, because of the way social media encourages people to be inappropriate with one another. And the idea of privacy is disappearing. I think that's really interesting that that's happened. I believe political awareness and activism, understanding how politics happens and how business happens, can help to make people more empathetic towards the fact that these decisions they make have knock-on consequences. But, you know, for people to get that, they have to understand systems, they have to understand macroeconomics, they have to understand politics and sociology. So you need really deep education for people to have a handle on this stuff, to go, oh my goodness, is this the world we're living in, and are these the features that feed this complex system? Now how do I break out of it? On the plus side, we have a project called HUMI, where we reach out to high school students in Clareton, Steel Valley, McKeesport, and Wilkinsburg. These students are incredibly aware of privacy issues, of food security, of the dangers they face when they walk home. You can get to specific students who are very much advocates for a better future, but their voice isn't thrown very far. You don't get to hear about them very much. That's not what the press writes about. So they do exist, and in a way we can foment that group of children, I think, to grow and expand. It could be the new cool to actually care, to be politically active, to be socially aware. But that's going to take a lot of work.
Back when the internet was fairly new, and JavaScript was new, I remember a data mining company selling to web content providers the ability to track, you don't have to put in your email address, you don't have to click on a box or anything. They actually tracked where your mouse went, how much you hovered over a certain place, and so forth. And then they stored in a database so that they could see what the most frequent things that they hover over was. I'm sure that's still being used. So going back to the first part of your talk with the cover of your book, how do you think Google chose their color for their logo?
Very cool, you look at the bottom of the
Oh, so something very similar.
Tweaking it so that we get by the rules, so Google doesn't tell them that's false advertising. And yet, if you can use it quickly, you can do whatever you want. Right? It's a giant game for them, and we're the lab mice.
Use the microphone.
Yes, sorry about that. I forgot.
Generationally, you're going between so many worlds. It's so cool how you're flying back and forth between folks. What are you seeing with the ways that the people under 18 are communicating versus those of us who are pre-technology, pre-internet?
Kids under 18, if I'm going to caricature this really badly. We had a conference where we brought in some award-winning video game designers from New York City who designed a United Nations simulation online. Incredibly nice game. They couldn't talk. What was really interesting is the act of conversing live and making eye contact and having long sentence-level interactions with somebody was just not something they've done. Because their communication acts are short, with very little eye contact, and a whole lot is done through digital media rather than live contact. So they take time, they have ideas, they write it down or they communicate it out, but they don't do this live banter that we at our generation, at your and my age, we're used to. That's my biggest caricature I would make, is that the art of conversation has changed absolutely dramatically. There's a microphone coming. I think they want to record it.
Okay. Oh, when I was looking for new auto insurance, I didn't want to start getting all kinds of ads from everybody. So I used the In Private browser, and I'm assuming that that's going to prevent, you know, the gods out there from knowing that I'm looking for insurance. Does the In Browser, is that doing the In Private browser, is that doing anything, or is that just...
There are certainly forms of tracking that you can defeat by switching to a private browser mode. There are certain types of tracking that perhaps an advertising company might be able to notice when you go from site A to site B to site C, and that might be defeated with some of these private browsing modes. But it doesn't work across everything. It might help, but it's not 100%.
One of the really interesting ones, by the way, down that path,
how many of you have received from your auto insurance company notification that you may save money if you let us put this small tracking device in your car. All right, at least 5-6 of us. This is the newest trick in the game. They install a GPS tracking unit in your car. And from now on, they can collect statistics on how you drive, how fast you go, do you come to a full stop at the stop sign. And the auto insurance companies are now telling people you may get a discount if you let us put this in your car. And when you put it in your car, you give them access to and you sign a form that says, I allow you to track my position for savings. So again, for a little bit of incremental savings, in fact, for an unknown amount of incremental savings, we don't even know how much of a savings it is, people will give up all information to a private company, not even the government, right? To a private company about everywhere they go, the speeds they go at, everything. And people are doing this. Insurance companies love it because they're able to analyze you, they're able to start charging you based on the miles you actually travel, and they're able to figure out exactly how much of a risk you are. Yes?
You have children who are near driving age, there's real incentives to build this into your cars now so that the parents can also know, in addition to the companies, whether they stopped at a full stop and were driving after 12 p.m. at night, et cetera. So I think that I wonder myself if that's the kind of thing that might eventually get the younger generation to start paying a little bit more attention to whether they're being tracked or not.
Any more questions? Well, thank you, Dr. Norbosch.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, everybody, for staying for the Q&A and coming out to Cafe Sci. We hope to see you next month on October 7th.